That is Maybelline, Chuck Berry's first hit and one of the first iconic American rock and roll songs. Berry, often called the father of rock and roll, died on Saturday at age 90 in St. Charles, Missouri. He surged to prominence in the 1950s with Maybelline and other hits like Johnny B. Good, Roll Over Beethoven, and Brown Eyed Handsome Man. He had such a huge impact that John Lennon once said, "If you had tried to give rock and roll another name, you might call it Chuck Berry." Wow. Joining me now for more on Berry's legacy is Tim Riley, professor of journalism at Emerson College. His most recent book is Lennon, Man, Myth, Music. Tim Riley, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Nice to be here.
So why is Chuck Berry so often called the father of rock and roll? Talk about that significance and where that name came to be.
Well, for many reasons, but not least of all because he invented that guitar lick that we heard at the top of that song, Maybelline, and he used it in a variety of different ways, but kind of it became a kind of standard template for the beginning of a lot of different rock and roll songs, and it became adapted and used and played with by virtually every other rock and roll who came after. If you want to sit down and learn rock and roll guitar, you're going to want to learn that Chuck Berry guitar lick. It is really the foundation out of which most rock and roll springs. So if he had done nothing else but invent that guitar lick, he would have done a lot.
However, that distinct sound.
Yeah, it's a very distinctive sound, and all guitarists know it. And it's one of the sounds you have to master as a rock and roll guitar player in order to fit it into your sound, wherever that sound is going to take you. He also wrote some of the great rock and roll classic songs, and he started writing about rock and roll almost as quickly as it came into existence. And so he was very important in dealing with the self-mythology of rock and roll. He dealt with the music as though it was a mythology, even before it really had a chance to earn its status as a giant mythology. He was singing about it as a towering musical style back in 1956 and 57 with songs like Johnny B. Good and Rock and Roll Music.
Mm-hmm.
And he was singing about it as though this is going to conquer everything and take over the world long before it actually did.
I don't mean to cut you off, but I want us to actually play a little bit the 1958 Johnny B. song about an illiterate country boy from New Orleans. So you were talking a little bit about the mythology, so talk a little bit more about that, about this song and what made it such a hit.
Well, that song really is the story of rock and roll. It's the fantasy, the dream that every rock and roll listener has as a kid. If you want to be a rock and roll star, you want to grow up and learn how to play guitar just like ringing a bell. That is, you know, make it sound really easy and like you're having fun and like that bell is really going to make a loud noise and
mm-hmm.
you're going to really make a dent in the world. He's doing that call and response in the refrain with his voice and his guitar, and that becomes a real trope that's used all throughout rock and roll. And the other key thing about that is that he sings about there lived a country boy named Johnny B. Good. And there was a wide swath of people who would have heard that song in the mid-50s and known that an alternate lyric could have been who lived a colored boy named Johnny B. Good. That country was kind of this coded word for, you know what, it really is black music that's getting very, very popular, and white people are making it very popular. So if he made him a country boy, he knew that was going to make the music popular. And he had this real, very strong, vivid, but never resentful or cynical racial awareness. People also talked about how he brought really good diction. You can understand every lyric in a Chuck Berry song when he sings it. And people early on mistook him for a white singer. They thought maybe this is a country singer kind of singing rhythm and blues.
I read that. I thought that was so interesting.
Yeah, very interesting, isn't it? And it kind of makes sense when you listen to it. It does not sound like the slurred words of a Mick Jagger or, you know, some of the later singers that came along. Chuck Berry's really interested in drilling these words right into your skull so that they stick with you.
I want to talk a little bit more about that time as well. Chuck Berry, Elvis Presley, and Little Richard were all part of that pioneering rock and roll time of the moment, of the 1950s. What do you think it was about those artists in that moment that gave rise to rock and roll? And did they even know each other at the time? Were they aware of each other?
They were very aware of each other and very self-conscious. In fact, one of my favorite quotes is about Jerry Lee Lewis's mom going to a show where they're both on the same bill. And she says to her son, Jerry Lee Lewis, after the show, "You know, son, you're okay, but that guy, Chuck Berry, he's rock and roll."
Really?
Which I just love. Wow. Chuck, I mean, Jerry Lee Lewis's mom. It's like an indelible quote.
Exactly.
And they saw themselves as participating in the same kind of mission, which was to take these black rhythms and sell them to a crossover audience. It was a signal that the Tin Pan Alley song tradition, the Frank Sinatra sort of song catalog that had been popular up to that point, was actually coming to an end and was kind of past ending. There was the pop industry was ready for something new. There was this idea that there was going to be a newness around the corner, and that people were anticipating it. And if you read some of the biographies of the figures in that era, Peter Guralnick's biography of Sam Phillips, Elvis Presley's producer, is very good on that, how the record companies really were anticipating a new trend, and rock and roll came up and fulfilled that idea. And a lot of people, like Sam Phillips, knew that it was going to be a combination of blacks and whites covering this sped-up R&B music, which made it danceable. And Chuck Berry was among the first to give it, like, all of these great teenage themes. He was describing the world that teenagers lived in and thought about, and he spoke directly to the teen audience.
And that was he was doing that on purpose, and he knew what he was doing, talking to them directly.
Yes, but not without, you know, not what we would call like a postmodern self-consciousness, not with quotes around it so much, but really affectionate and really like, you know, I really get what teenagers have on their minds and why it's so important to them. And it was kind of like, you know, he was taking the teenage worldview, the teenage experience, and saying, hey, this is just as relevant a point of view as anything else. Like, if you're a teenager, this is how you look at the world. Why don't we validate this? And that was a brand new idea back in the mid-50s.
So I hear that going to one of his concerts was really like almost a religious experience.
Oh, yeah.
We talked with a local singer-songwriter, Dennis Brennan, and he talks a bit about the Chuck Berry concert he went to at a movie theater in Worcester, Massachusetts, when he was 18.
Some friends of mine were lucky enough to be asked to be his backup band. Chuck's history with this is that, you know, he doesn't even care about his backup band. He just pulls into town, the promoter hire a band, and they back him up as best they can. Well, these guys, they learned the songs. The first 15 minutes, he's not paying attention to the band, and they're trying to keep up with him. And about 20 minutes in, all of a sudden, it all starts to pull together. It was the best concert I've ever seen.
What was the impact on Berry's music to local artists?
I mean, Springsteen was actually one of these guys who got into a local pickup band and backed up Chuck Berry when he was a teenager. And so if you had, you know, you could imagine how it would feel if you're a teenager. You're like, lightning strikes, Chuck Berry's coming to town. Oh, my God, I get to back up Chuck Berry. But he was famous for being kind of difficult on stage, for throwing out really weird key signatures to people. And Keith Richards has a quote at the end of that Hail, Hail rock and roll movie where he says, "Oh, Chuck Berry, more headaches than Mick Jagger." Because he really liked to just play. He liked to put people on. He liked to play pranks on people. And on stage, that meant, you know, you might have rehearsed the song in A, or maybe the song on the record was in A, but he would pull it out in E-flat. Just, all right, we're doing it in E-flat today. Here we go, 1, 2, 3, and just like giving you no notice. And what he wanted was that spontaneity and that accidental kind of like people falling into it and having to sort of create it, make it up as they went along.
Thank you so much, Tim Riley. This was wonderful to talk with you a bit about Chuck and Berry and his life and legacy. We're going to go out today with Roll Over Beethoven. It's Chuck Berry's 1956 hit. And thank you again, Tim Riley, professor of journalism at Emerson College. His recent book, Lennon, Man, Myth, Music. Thank you, Tim.
Thank you.
That's it for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Tanya Mosley, and this is Radio Boston. Hey, diddle, diddle, I'ma play my fiddle. Ain't got nothing to lose. Roll over Beethoven, tell Tchaikovsky the news. You know she wiggle like a glowworm, dance like a spinning top. She got a crazy partner, you ought to see him reel and rock. Long as she got a dime, the music won't never stop. I roll over Beethoven.